View My Seats podcast for Friday, February 13th. I'm your host, John Lord. My guest today, Sam Vecenie, writer for CBS Sports, covering both college basketball and the NBA. Sam, welcome to the View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to be on. I think it's going to be a fun little podcast here. It's 9 o'clock on a sunny Friday morning in Los Angeles, so pretty excited by the day. Pretty excited with what it could bring.
You have nothing to complain about because us in the Northeast are preparing for another snowstorm, perhaps a blizzard. So enjoy that weather.
Oh man, not going to be a fun weekend with All-Star Weekend coming up for some of those NBA stars that live in the West Coast.
That's right. Let's start there. Actually, so the NBA is descending on New York City for All-Star Weekend, and this past week, NBA.com released a really cool interactive feature titled "A History of New York City Basketball," and you can go and scroll across all the boroughs and learn about the local players, coaches, and broadcasters that really made New York City the center, the epicenter of basketball in the United States. My question for you, Sam, is, and let's take the Knicks and Nets out of the equation for the time being, but do you believe New York is still regarded as the best basketball city in the country? And if not, when and why did it all change?
I don't think it is anymore. I think that over the last decade, probably, it's been Chicago. Just because you've got guys coming into the league like Derrick Rose, Jabari Parker, you're going to have Jahlil Okafor next year. It just seems like a lot of the best players in high school are coming out of Chicago at this point. And I don't really know why that is. And there was even a point with Durant, with Ty Lawson, with a lot of guys where Prince George County in like the Baltimore area was considered one of the best places for talent in just hoops generally, especially in high school hoops and then college hoops and moving forward to the NBA. You know, it's hard for me to really put a finger on why. I wouldn't say that New York's gone downhill, but it's hard for me to really figure out why it seems like fewer players are being produced in New York. I think that I read a stat like over the last 5 years or something, over the last 4 years maybe, there's only been one McDonald's All-American from the city of New York, or it might even be zero. And part of that speaks to the fact that those guys just tend to go to New Jersey schools. They'll tend to go to Massachusetts schools, just for basketball and go play high school basketball there for whatever reason, to get out of the city and to go to those stronger prep school program kind of things. So that was my best guess on why, but those guys are still being produced in New York, and it seems like there are even fewer of those guys. Do you really have a guess on why that would be?
Well, I have a few ideas, but it's amazing when you look at the map, just the amount of the sheer history, the volume of history that New York has produced is really just astounding, and you can learn so much from looking at this feature from NBA.com. And the reason I started with "Is New York still the epicenter of basketball in this country?" is because really there's the city hasn't produced the players, the programs, the tradition in the last 10 to 20 years. And it's noticeable as soon as you go to this feature and you look at all the pictures. They're all from an older generation. And
yeah,
you know, my guess would be as good as yours. One of the things I did want to ask you about, though, is that, you know, cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Baltimore and other parts of the country have been around for longer than 10 to 20 years. So I wonder what's changed in the last 10 to 20 years to kind of shift the spotlight away from New York City to other metro areas in the country. And, you know, kind of piggybacking on your idea about how, you know, prep schools and a lot of athletes from New York look to escape high school to go play in other parts of the country. I wondered about AAU basketball and what kind of an impact AAU basketball has had on local New York high school programs. Because I don't know if this is 100% the case, but it seems to me that with the rise of AAU, that the high school basketball season is almost secondary to the AAU basketball season, in the sense that players are discovered on the AAU circuit more than they are when they play for their high schools. And when you look at a lot of the history of New York City, there are some really unbelievable basketball programs, at least from back in the day, Christ the King in Queens, Archbishop Molloy, Lincoln High School in Brooklyn. These places used to produce the best talent in the country, but they're not anymore. And I wonder if that has something to do with AAU.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty good hypothesis. I mean, who was the last great player out of New York? Was it Lance? Might have been Lance Stevenson at this point, right?
Just looking, and I spend a lot of time with this map, and I really the contemporary players, you know, you have Lance Stevenson, then you have Stephon Marbury and Sebastian Telfair.
Kemba's from New York, isn't he?
Kemba Walker, yeah. But then you have female athletes too, like Sue Bird, and I think it was Tina Charles. So, but you know, you don't really have that transcendent talent like you used to. You don't have Kenny Smith. You don't have Mark Jackson. You don't have, you know, Pearl Washington going back, you know, that far. You just don't have those players anymore.
Yeah, Chris Mullin is another really good example. And it's just so hard to put a finger on it. And I think you're probably on the money as far as hypothesizing that it probably does have something to do with, like, the AAU kind of world that we live in. Yeah, it's just really hard to put a finger on it. I mean, you look at some of this talent that's on this thing. You can even see into the 90s there are great people, because Chris Mullin even played into the 90s. I'm just, like, scrolling through them. This map is just vast. I would suggest that everyone goes here and looks at this. But even guys like Anthony Mason, it's just an incredible, incredible thing to look at, and there's so much history here, and it's just really hard to say. Like, maybe it, I also wonder what the impact is of St. John's going, not necessarily, I mean, it has gone downhill, there's not really a way around that, but even like the New York universities haven't been as strong with college basketball recently, so there are a lot of weird, like, possibilities as to why this New York, I wouldn't say there's a dearth of talent in New York, but it's definitely gone down a little bit. And I don't really have an explanation as to why that would be. But, like, even guys like Lamar Odom and Ron Artest, Medov, whatever you want to call them, those are probably your two best recent players out of New York, and they're borderline all-star players whose careers are basically done at this point.
Go ahead. You're mentioning this perhaps there's something of a trickle down effect.
Yeah.
Which is that as college basketball programs in New York City kind of lose their appeal, lose their draw, lose a lot of the standards that they used to really hold, as far as, you know, St. John's and Fordham and even NYU. I mean, we don't talk about those programs being national programs anymore. And then you go to the professional teams, and I wanted to leave the Knicks and the Nets out of it to start, but because it's too easy to go there. But I do wonder if the reason why basketball in New York isn't what it used to be, and I think we're now just gonna assume that it isn't. Let's just say that it isn't.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other way around it. Like, okay, I think it pretty much it isn't at this.
Yeah,
point.
We'll establish that it's not. And I wonder if a lot of that has to do with the New York Knicks and their current ineptitude, and really they haven't been a very good team for a little while now. And I wonder if there is such a thing as a trickle-down effect, that the way the professional teams go, the way that the college teams go, so goes the high school.
I could buy that a little bit. I mean, it goes towards the idea of identifying with your city as far as the basketball within your city. And obviously it all is going to start with the Knicks. You know, the Nets just moved back to, or just moved to New York. So I don't really know that it would be that as far as what we're talking about here, but New York, the Knicks, like, they haven't been great since Patrick Ewing left. They never even won a title with Ewing. So, like, it's hard to say that people growing up then identified with the Knicks as being this team that you wanted to aspire to be. And let's be honest, those 90s Knicks teams weren't exactly the most enjoyable thing to watch in the world either.
Right.
So it's very possible that there is a trickle-down effect as far as just identifying with your own city as far as basketball is concerned. Like, a lot of these kids, like, maybe they wouldn't leave New York if they thought that they're – if they identified more – centrally with their basketball within New York. And that all starts with the Knicks being as they are. And then it trickles down to St. John's, Fordham, like you said, being what they are as far as basketball. And St. John's is making a bit of a comeback, but
yeah, think about it this way. Think about it this way though, Sam, the city that you mentioned as kind of usurping New York's throne as far as
Chicago
is Chicago. Now, 25 years ago, the Chicago Bulls started what is perhaps one of the best runs in NBA history.
Yeah.
So applying the logic that you just established to the Knicks not being good and perhaps that having an impact on New York City basketball, maybe that's the Bulls' success was one of the reasons why youth basketball in Chicago has gotten so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible. Maybe these kids just got into basketball and maybe they would have gotten into something else had they not seen Michael Jordan, or maybe basketball fans moved into Chicago to see Michael Jordan and had children while that was happening. There are a lot of really good explanations, and I think that the trickle-down effect from the Knicks is an entirely possible reason as to why basketball isn't really as strong as it has been in the past in New York. I mean, again, I'm just trying to like think back. I know that Joakim Noah is from New York, but I don't really, for some reason, I don't know why, I just don't identify Joakim Noah with New York for some reason. Like, I've seen the Lenny Cook documentary, where he's like knows Lenny Cook. He, helped produce that documentary, I'm pretty sure. So like, he tries to closely identify within New York basketball, but like, for some reason, I identify him more with Florida. Like, even a lot of the guys from New York now, like Taj Gibson went to USC. Like, I just identify them with different places even, and that doesn't help the New York, I wouldn't say a basketball problem, but the idea that New York is losing its luster as far as producing great basketball talent.
Yet there's still such a rich history. And
yes,
if you ever have an opportunity to go to a college basketball game in the New York metro area, you go to places like Fordham University and you sit in Rose Hill Gymnasium. I mean, you feel as if you are a part of basketball history. That is still such a cool fan experience. It's almost too bad that some of these college basketball programs aren't as good as they used to be, because there's still such a rich tradition that, from a fan's perspective, is a lot of fun to be a part of.
Yeah, no, it's a really weird really weird phenomenon that is happening, and hopefully New York gets it back. I mean, I think it would be really great for the sport of basketball in general if New York could kind of pull things back together a little bit and keep producing that exceptional talent that they did in the 70s and 80s.
And so maybe something like an All-Star weekend does help to turn things around, although I don't necessarily believe that, because I think a lot of us who watch basketball and who have, you know, grown up watching basketball feel as if the All-Star game has lost some of that luster that it used to have when we were kids. And, you know, this is an obvious statement, everyone says it, but it used to be an event, you know, when you were younger, and maybe it still is for kids, we're older, but, you know, it used to be something that you made sure you blocked time out for, and you watched the dunk contest, you watched the three-point shootout, you made sure that you saw the game. And I personally don't necessarily have that sense anymore. I mean, I'm sure it's still incredibly popular with kids, but, you know, from my perspective, it's not must-watch TV. So do you think the All-Star game still matters?
So I'm weird in that I love all of this stuff. I love all of this.
Sorry.
Like, I love All-Star Saturday. It's one of my favorite events of the year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't love the game, though. The problem is the game has lost all of its luster. I enjoy All-Star Saturday so much more than I enjoy the game itself. The game itself feels like a come down almost for me,
right,
from what All-Star Saturday has become, with all the showy glitz and all of the glamour and everything that you really get. It seems like you get to know the basketball players themselves a little bit better over the course of this weekend on Friday with the Rising Stars now, and on Saturday with this great event, these great events like the three-point shootout, and then these young players, you know, competing in the dunk contest. That's where stars have been made in the past, like Dwight Howard. Like, we haven't forgotten about Nate Robinson because he won multiple dunk contests at this point. Like, it's where stars are made. And then on Sunday, it's just like the actual stars are there. And I'm just like, you know what? It's fine. Like, these guys aren't going as hard as they should. They're not even as hard as they should, because I can't even say that they should go hard in a game like this. But like, it's clear they're not playing super hard. It's not like they should. Like, there's no real reason, there's no incentive for them at this point. And that kind of sucks, but it just is what it is, you know what I mean? And I don't really know how you go about fixing the All-Star game itself.
So in your mind, it might not be broken. In mind, it just seems like a relic from the past that I don't necessarily need to watch, but I don't follow it as closely as you do. I'll tell you one thing that I found interesting is I don't know where this was reported. It could have been the New York Times. It could have been ESPN. But I read a story about how as much as All-Star Weekend is for the fans, and the NBA does such an incredible job at marketing themselves and marketing their stars and making themselves accessible and open to the public, but the games and events themselves are pretty much a corporate event. And there was something in the article that talked about how pretty much all of the tickets in the arenas, the Barclays Center for Saturday night and Sunday's All-Star game in Madison Square Garden, those tickets have already been allotted to corporations and the NBA teams. So, as you know, they're going to hit the secondary market and, you know, go on StubHub for $2,500. But for the most part, the games and the activities themselves Saturday night aren't for the fans.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting thing that I hadn't known. I mean, it's one of those things you can kind of figure just the way the game is going now as far as, like, it's corporate sponsorship and everything. But, you know, it's something that kind of sucks as far as I don't want to say real basketball fans, but as far as, like, basketball fans maybe not being able to get in, it's a corporate event. Like you said, like, it sucks, but I don't really know how it necessarily affects the ambiance of the game. I mean, maybe people would get more excited about it. Maybe, like, your average Joe fan would get a lot more excited if they could actually go to the event. It's just a weird, that's a weird thing that's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around, I guess.
But again, that's not to take anything away from what the NBA does, because I think of all the professional sports leagues, the NBA does perhaps the best job at appealing to such a wide cross section of fans.
It does.
You have young, old, black, white. The NBA is so good at marketing itself to all different types. But I did think that was interesting, and it adds to kind of the exclusivity of the event. Switching gears from the All-Star game slightly. Sam, I know you also cover college basketball, and so I have a question about some college basketball players, and let's just say this time next year, I don't even know where the All-Star game is next year, but this time
in
next
Toronto.
Year, it's in Toronto. Oh, that's cool. This time next year in Toronto, are there any current college basketball players that you would expect to be a part of next year's All-Star weekend festivities in Toronto?
I don't think anyone will make the All-Star game next year necessarily, but I think that there are a couple of guards that will probably be in, like, that skills competition thing. You'll have D'Angelo Russell at Ohio State, and probably Emmanuel Mudiay, who is playing in China right now. He decided to go professional out of high school just so he can make some money as insurance, just in case anything would happen. And plus, there was a little bit of a controversy as far as he went to that Dion charter school that got shut down.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah, it wasn't sure if he was going to be eligible or not. He had passed the NCAA. He had passed SMU's clearinghouse, but not the NCAA's or something along those lines. So yeah, I think that those two will probably be a part of it next year. As far as dunk contest guys, I can see like a Stanley Johnson maybe popping into the dunk contest, but next year isn't necessarily like your crazy athlete draft, which is a lot more, which brings out like the fun guys like Zach LaVine. Zach LaVine's not a particularly good basketball player at this point, but he's a really, really good dunk contest guy to have around. So there's no necessarily like amazing, terrific athlete that I can point to and say that guy's going to be in the dunk contest next year. But Stanley Johnson might, maybe Rondae Hollis-Jefferson if he comes out. But yeah, I would say that next year is more of like an actually good draft class, because the part of the thing is with that draft class, it features a lot of big guys, and big guys don't necessarily end up as a part of All-Star Weekend unless they're in the game.
You've mentioned Emmanuel Mudiay, and you know, I've followed your work recently, and you've spent a lot of time writing about a rookie for the Philadelphia 76ers named KJ McDaniels.
Yes.
And what's interesting to me, as an observer of the NBA and college basketball, is that it doesn't seem like the traditional path to the NBA is what it used to be. And you know, you have Moutier playing in China for a year, and mm-hmm. then he's going to be eligible for the draft next year. And you have KJ McDaniels, who was drafted in the second round, and he decided to, instead of signing a longer-term deal with the 76ers, he took a flyer on a single-year contract. And, you know, are the rules starting to favor more the players than the league, than the teams? Or is this still a proposition that works in favor of the NBA and of college basketball? I think what I'm trying to get at is, do players now have more options? Do players now have more of an ability to control their own destiny as far as the money that they eventually make?
I absolutely think they have more options. I think that's kind of undeniable at this point. But it, again, still the NBA that holds all of the power. Like KJ McDaniels, he had to sign a minimum non-guaranteed one-year contract that gets offered to all second-round picks, right? So say he gets hurt in training camp, McDaniels probably gets cut, honestly. Like, that's not out of the realm of possibility. So between that and between the fact that we've seen kids like Brandon Jennings, Emmanuel Mudiay go over to Europe, and the next big one that might actually do that is the number one kid in the 2016 class, Thon Maker, who, if you watch any sort of high school basketball, if you look into any sort of recruiting, you've probably seen videos of Thon Maker. He's like 7 foot tall and plays on the perimeter and knocks down threes like it's nothing. He's going to be a really, really good player, but he's debating whether or not he wants to reclassify and go to college next year, if he wants to go professional over in Europe for a year or over in Australia for a year. It's a really interesting situation. I think if he does it again, it's just going to keep pointing to that idea that there are a lot more options for kids than there have been in the past. It's a really, really interesting thing. It's really, really hard to, say that the NBA doesn't hold the power, because they do, clearly. But the fact that the salary cap is going to go up in the next couple of years, that's going to help players out a lot, I think. I think you're going to start seeing more second-round picks take the McDaniels route, where they're not going to sign these crazy like option contracts, like the one that Chandler Parsons signed in Houston, where he got 4 years, essentially, and then got two of them as team options. Like, it's just a really, really differing landscape, and it's really, really going to be interesting to watch how it changes throughout the next few years.
Where do you stand as far as eligibility goes in regards to players turning pro? Do you feel as if there are more changes that need to occur in the college level in order to make it fairer to the players themselves, or do you think things should, you know, be somewhat kept status quo, where you can't go to the NBA directly from high school?
I generally think that you should be able to go right out of high school if you want to, and if a team is willing to select you. I like the idea of like the baseball rule, where you either have to go straight out of high school or have to stay for 2 years. Mostly because I think that the problem with the one-year rule is you're changing your development cycles a lot within the one-year rule. Like, you're going from one program in high school to another program in college to another NBA program. I think it's a lot for, like, these 18 through 20-year-olds to handle at that point in their lives, and that makes it a lot more difficult to really latch onto a system and really develop. So I think that, like, if you just took out either a year where a guy can go straight out of high school and then go to the D League and be within a system that he is going to get comfortable with professionally, that would really help with development cycles. And then I think if you had to stay for a second year in college, you'd be able to kind of get used to that program and really, really figure everything out and really, really develop as a player. You'd get a full summer instead of transitioning straight from college to the NBA, where you're still in like full transition mode for that entire year. Like, if you had to stay 2 years, I think you'd actually start to develop more as both as a person and both as a player as well, because you'd actually get a summer to work out instead of a summer where your life is just a whirlwind at that point.
And the fact of the matter is that a lot of these college basketball players that do only stay in their programs for a year, their college programs in a year, they're really only there for a semester.
Right.
The only thing that matters is staying eligible for the first semester, and then the second semester, Most of them leave to train and prepare for the NBA draft anyway, those that have committed to just staying 1 year. So it is something that as an observer, I wonder about. And I heard something about how the NBA D League, that they might do something where players that are interested in turning professional out of high school can go play in the D League. Mm-hmm. And then if things fizzle out for them at the D League, if they need to more seasoning, as you put it, that they have the option of then going to college. Am I getting that right? Has that been talked about?
I haven't heard anything along those lines.
I might have gotten that wrong.
I don't really know how the NCAA would really legislate that, because I mean, if you're getting paid in the D League, it's going to be, I don't know how you're still going to be eligible for the NCAA at that point. So that would have to be an agreement between the NBA, the D League, and the NCAA, and I don't really know that that'll happen anytime soon. It's just a really, really tough, it's a tough nut to crack, because you have all of these moving pieces. And the biggest problem right now that I see is the D League salary structure, because I don't know that I really see a reason for these kids to go to the D League monetarily right now. You're only going to make $40,000, $50,000 if you're going straight to the D League, because that's what most D League players make. You can go over to Europe for a year and make probably mid six figures, maybe like $500,000. You can go to China, make $1 million if you're a top prospect like Moutier proved this year. You can go to Australia, probably, where their basketball infrastructure is really rising and really improving. It's just really, really hard right now, I think, for the D League to gain any traction. That I think that's going to be a really, really big tipping point of this CBA discussion that's coming up in the next few years. Whether or not they can get enough of a strong infrastructure in the D League to make it a full minor league system, that every team has an affiliate, and part of that problem is just geographically, it's pretty tough to do that and pretty tough to find stadiums and everything like that. And then the second part is going to be really upping the salary structure. If you can do that, I think you're going to see a lot more kids want to stay home, and possibly do want to go to the D League straight out of high school. And I think that would actually be a really, really good thing. Cause I think the D League is probably I know that a lot of the D League, a lot of it's these guys gunning for NBA jobs, and it's not necessarily a great structure as far as the way that they play, just because, like I said, these guys are really gunning for jobs, and they're going to be gunning for shots a lot of the time. So it's not a great systemic thing. But you know what? They'd still get to work with some of the best coaches in the world, developmentally, and they'd get to work with the NBA teams if it was a one-to-one system, like in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City has one of the best ones around right now. So I think that if we can really work on the infrastructure of the D League, that would be a possibility to give kids more options coming out of high school.
You know, you mentioned you're talking about the salary structure of the NBA D League, and it's fascinating because minor league baseball has forever faced a very similar problem, where mm-hmm. the players that play in the minor leagues do not receive any kind of there's no such thing as minimum wage. And so a lot of these minor league baseball players really struggle financially. And mm-hmm. and that's okay with the majority of owners, because the majority of owners look at their minor league systems as, you know, they're basically just fillers trying to put something entertaining on the field. But they don't see a lot of their talent coming up through the minor leagues. You know, they identify their one, two handful of guys that they think have a shot to make the big league club. They don't look at the majority of minor league ball players as, you know, people who have a chance to eventually play in the majors. And that's why owners, at least, don't feel the need to change the salary structure in minor league baseball. I am, you know, as a fan, I like to complain, like a lot of fans do, that college basketball, you know, you have it's so hard to watch college basketball because you don't know the players anymore, and you know, you have all these guys that just play for one season, and it's so hard to really have any continuity. And that's, you know, me as a fan complaining, and it's not an unexpected complaint. But when you look at the top 10 of college basketball this year, outside of Kentucky, I mean, how many schools would you say are one-and-done type institutions where, you know, there isn't continuity, where there isn't there aren't players that stay for more than 1-2 years? I mean, look at the top five. You have Kentucky, obviously, but then outside of Kentucky, look at schools like Virginia and Wisconsin. I mean, those are places where kids go for more than 1-2 years, right?
Yeah, typically. This year seems to be a weirder year with that. I think part of it was the freshman class has proven itself to be really, really, really strong and really, really deep this year, which is kind of, again, it was kind of a surprise. I was going to say that this freshman class wasn't nearly as heralded as the 2013 recruiting class with your Wiggins, Jabari Parkers, your guys of that ilk. I would actually give you a little bit of pushback as far as there not being as many one-and-done institutions, just because schools like Arizona is going to have a one-and-done this year for the second year in a row. Stanley Johnson this year, Aaron Gordon was last year. Duke had Jabari Parker last year. They're going to have Jahlil Okafor and Justice Winslow this year at least, possibly Tyus Jones as well. Kansas is at least going to have one in Kelly Oubre, probably two in Cliff Alexander a year after having Wiggins. So I think there are quite a few one and dones. Ohio State's going to have D'Angelo Russell probably. UCLA is going to have Kevon Looney after Zach LaVine last year. So there are some one and dones for sure. But like you said, a lot of those top programs, the best programs are the ones where you can get kids to stick around for multiple years at this point, unless you're Kentucky. You're seeing Virginia really start to rise doing that. You're seeing Gonzaga start to rise doing that. Wisconsin's been doing this for years. That's why they're always so terrific. Villanova's been really, really strong over the last few years because of this. So I think that as far as college basketball is concerned, your best teams probably are going to be the teams with the less identifiable all-stars, unless your name is Kentucky and you're getting these incredible kids year in, year out, because John Calipari's a wizard. But
right. And that was my point originally, which is that, you know, we like to complain, at least, you know, fans like to complain about how, oh, college basketball, I don't know any of the teams, any of the players. And outside of the Kentuckys and the Arizonas and the Kansases and the Dukes, the majority of the schools that are going to be competing through March are schools that do keep their players, are schools where there is continuity. So the game does still have a lot of I don't want to say depth of talent, but if you are a fan and you watch the game regularly, you should be able to get to know these players. So therefore, that complaint is not totally fair.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And part of the problem is, as far as college basketball right now, is that it's somewhat unwatchable in general, and I cover it, like, for a living, and I have no problem saying that. It's slow. This is going to be the slowest college basketball season ever as far as pace of play. Teams are averaging something less than 66 possessions per 40 minutes, which is ridiculous in every single realm. So that's part of a problem. These referees are a disaster. These block charge calls allow for either way, way too much physicality at the rim or not nearly enough physicality at the rim, depending on what referee you get on any given night. Perimeter defenders are basically allowed to mug players on the perimeter to stop them from getting penetration, the Aaron Kraft syndrome, so to speak. Part of it is that college basketball is generally just, it needs some rule changes. Like they're actually going to shorten the shot clock this year for the NIT to try and learn a little bit more about whether or not that will increase pace of play. They're trying to experiment with a larger semicircle, restricted area near the rim to see if it makes it a little bit easier on officials as far as being able to, call blocks and charges and maybe make the game a little bit less physical around the rim. So it's going to be really interesting to see if we can get college basketball in a more watchable plane. But going back to the Stars thing, I think that's a fair point. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see if the Stars rise in this NCAA tournament, like your Arizonas, your Ohio States with D'Angelo Russell, your Texas's with Miles Turner, or if it's going to be your Virginia's, Wisconsin's, Gonzaga's, Villanova's, who have these older, more experienced players that, you know, NBA fans might not really be watching all that much.
All the problems you just described in college basketball seem to stem from the Wisconsin Badgers. I'm a Wisconsin fan, so I can say that somewhat jokingly. But as far as the pace of play and as far as the block charge, I mean, those seems to be things that Bo Ryan and the Badgers do quite well. Before I let you go, Sam Vecenie from CBS Sports, I do have to ask you. It's February. March is right around the corner. If you had to pick a Final Four today, who would you pick?
I would absolutely pick Kentucky. I would pick Virginia. And then depending on the way the stupid bracket breaks down every year, it's always so tough. I would say that the four best teams right now are Kentucky, Virginia, Gonzaga, and Wisconsin. And then Duke would be a close fifth.
That's pretty chalk there, Sam. You don't care to go out on a limb and make a case for, let's say, a team outside the top 25?
I could probably make a case for someone like Oklahoma, who is in that 18 range. They have a really, really, really good defense, and then they have the star power in Buddy Hield, who will be, I think he's going to be an NBA player for a while. Or I could, probably make a case for, I'm trying to think of an outside the top 25 team. I might be able to make a case for a Providence, who has one of the best 1-2 punches in the NCAA, and Chris Dunn, who I think is going to be a first round pick whenever he comes out, and LaDonte Henton. But I don't know. I think this is setting up to be a chalky year after last year's madness.
It's the 13th of February, Sam Vecenie. I'm putting you down for Virginia, Kentucky, Wisconsin, and Providence.
I don't know if you do that. No.
Okay.
I'd go Wisconsin, but
okay. Not Providence. Well, Sam, I appreciate you taking the time. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too, John.
Thank you.